Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm Oliver Wiseman, and if you're listening to this after Wednesday the 3rd of July, I'm the former editor of CapEx. The guest for my final episode as host of this podcast is arguably one of the world's most influential public intellectuals. Steven Pinker is professor of psychology at Harvard and the author of bestsellers that include The Better Angels of Our Nature, The Blank Slate, and most recently, Enlightenment Now. Published last year, Enlightenment Now makes the case for reason, science, humanism, and progress. Its message echoes a big part of what we try to do here at CapEx, and that's offering a counterbalance to the pessimism and declinism that dominates too much of our politics. In the book, Professor Pinker meticulously charts the many ways in which life has got a lot better over the last few hundred years. If that's a project that sounds fairly controversial, Enlightenment Now has provoked some surprisingly strong reactions. I sat down with Professor Pinker to talk about his latest book, the response to it, and what he thinks the biggest threats are to the Enlightenment values that have proved so crucial to human progress. So I wanted to start by asking you about how you kind of found this project that I think is a sort of two-book project, at least so far, in Better Angels and Enlightenment Now, in terms of explaining the data that shows that the world isn't quite as terrible as we maybe think it is. I mean, is this something you had always thought, or were you kind of pessimistic until you stumbled across some numbers about something?
Yeah, it's admittedly, it was a circuitous path from a guy who once wrote a book on irregular verbs.
Yeah, exactly.
And in fact, my paper trail, if anything, would be one that would point toward a rather pessimistic, dark outlook on the human condition, which is which I sometimes remind people of when they typecast me as a temperamental optimist. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book called The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature, arguing that human beings are not blank slates, that we come equipped, thanks to evolution, with a number of not-so-pleasant motives and drives, like revenge, like dominance. We have a capacity for sadism, nepotism, for magical thinking, demonization, tribalism. Homo sapiens is a nasty business, so I argued in The Blank Slate. That itself, that book itself came from a experience in trying to explain the human mind. Although I have concentrated on language, I am a cognitive psychologist. I'm interested in all aspects of how the mind works, and I wrote a book called How the Mind Works, trying to explain how we see, how we remember, why we have some emotions, why we have certain social connections. To my surprise, much of the negative reaction to how the mind works came from the very idea that there is such a thing as human nature, because there is emotional and political and moral baggage surrounding the concept of human nature. And a kind of progressive current that likes to deny that human nature exists, because then it is easier to design an ideal society on a blank sheet of paper, if humans themselves are blank sheets of paper and their traits come from parental upbringing, cultural messages, socialization. Well, just change the social programming, you change the human being, you design the society you want. An acknowledgement of human nature, it would seem, in this way of looking at things, would be reactionary. It would say, "Oh, you can't change human nature, so we'll never have the society that that ideally we would want if we could design it from the ground up." Mm-hmm. So there has been historically something of an alignment between innatist views of human nature and more conservative politics. Mm. I wrote The Blank Slate to try to dive into that that pool of ideas and to separate the empirical or scientific question of what makes us tick from the moral, political, and emotional baggage, arguing that even if we are equipped with some rather unsavory traits, human nature is complex, and there are other parts of human nature that can lead us to improve our lot. There's emotional faculties like empathy. There's a capacity of self-control, so we don't act on all of our ugly impulses. We are cognitive creatures who figure out how the world works and solve problems. We have language, so we can share our discoveries and our insights and our possible solutions. And I noted almost as in passing in the book The Blank Slate that there can't really be a debate as to whether we're incapable of changing society, because we know we have changed society, often from the better. Slavery was abolished. The Soviet Empire collapsed with very little violence. There were data suggesting that tribal societies were much more violent than modern societies. And when I reiterated those comments on a blog post responding to the question, what are you optimistic about, I started to receive correspondence from experts in a number of fields of history, political science, sociology, economics, saying you could have added examples of historical declines of violence. They said, did you know that rates of death in war have come down since 1946 by a lot? Did you know that every European country for which we have data has shown a dramatic decline in homicide since the Middle Ages? Did you know that rates of rape and sexual assault are down and rates of child abuse? And getting these data sent to me from independent researchers shocked me. I had not realized that the news was that good. It led me to believe that this should be more widely known, because it is a picture of the historical trajectory of the world that you cannot get from journalism, because journalism, by concentrating on all the things that go wrong, is oblivious to the rate at which things go wrong, because it doesn't cover the things that go right. The cliche in journalism is we cover the plane crashes, not the planes that take off. So I realized that there was a need simply to make these data sets available to a wider population, and to take on the challenge as a psychologist to try to explain them. What is it that leads people to be violent in the first place, and what resources did evolution give us to try to control that violence? So that was The Better Angels of Our Nature. Mm-hmm. I took a detour back to language, and I wrote a style manual, The Sense of Style, informed by modern linguistics and cognitive science. But then I went back to the theme of human progress, when, again, I had an epiphany that this did not come from any optimistic temperament, that it wasn't just in violence where the world had shown progress, but in almost every measure of human flourishing. Poverty had plummeted. Disease had plummeted. Illiteracy had plummeted. Human lifespan had increased. Famines were becoming rarer. And when I became aware of these other documented instances of human progress, I realized that needed a book. Again, both to make people aware of major developments in human history that most people are utterly ignorant of, and to do my best to explain it, which I did in terms of a defense of ideas that I thought were historically instrumental in propelling this progress, namely reason, science, and humanism.
And these are the core sort of values of the Enlightenment.
Exactly. Yeah. So I chose the Enlightenment Now as the title, because that was a well-known rubric for this a quartet of ideas, if you include progress. It was not, as some people thought, a a defense of a bunch of guys who wrote in the second half of the 18th century, mm-hmm. although in some cases it was, but it was it would be contrary to the ideals of the Enlightenment to say, let's go back to these sages and do exegesis on what they wrote and show that they had it all figured out 250 years ago. Mm-hmm. That defeats the whole purpose of reason and science, which constantly seeks to test its ideas, to update its ideas, to falsify ideas that are false. But that was a major misunderstanding of the point of the book.
Hmm. And I mean, at least to me, pointing out, as you say, in a very sort of data-heavy way, pointing out the progress humanity's made and attributing some of that progress to these very widely, you know, regarded, you know, well-regarded values of the Enlightenment is a sort of, it sort of sounds uncontroversial in a way. It sort of sounds like it should be.
You would think.
But as the tone of your voice implies, there's a sort of bit of a backlash to the book. And I'm interested in what you think explains that backlash.
Yeah. Some of it is comes from systematic misconceptions that are driven by an interaction between the nature of cognition and the nature of journalism. The feature of cognition that I think warps our view of the world is sometimes called the availability heuristic or the mm-hmm. availability bias, namely that we, in assessing how prevalent something is, we rack our brain for instances, for narratives, for images, for anecdotes. And if we read about a terrorist attack that morning, we think that terrorism must be on the rise or it's a major threat to life and limb. If we read of a shark attack, we don't go into the water. And that's what newspapers give us or journalistic websites.
Mm-hmm. It's all our fault, basically.
Pardon?
It's all the journalists' fault.
It's partly the journalists and the intellectuals' fault because a surprising number of historians and political scientists will weave narratives out of case studies without asking the question of how representative they are, how prevalent they are, whether there's been a historical trajectory in one direction or another. There's a lot of resistance to the use of data by historians, even though you can't use the words better or worse or more or less without at least implicitly alluding to data. Those are mm-hmm. inherently quantitative claims, and if you just make them based on examples, you are a victim of this this cognitive fallacy. So part of the opposition just comes from incredulity driven by a distorted view of the world from journalism. And I've argued separately that this should lead to a more quantitatively sophisticated form of journalism, where I think that the news should borrow a leaf from the page of the sports section and the business section, and for that matter, the weather, which reports the indicators whichever way they go, up, down, or no change, mm-hmm. Systematically every single day, mm-hmm. Whereas the news only reports spectacular things that go wrong. Mm-hmm. It'd be like having sports coverage only when your team gets trounced. but there's also, that's not the only source of incredulity and opposition. There's also a political motive to deny progress. Namely, if you are a major critic of the current establishment, the status quo, rhetorically, it is convenient to say that things are deteriorating and then you blame the deterioration on whatever your particular demon is. And to say that things have gone better is to concede that not everything in the current institutions is corrupt and rotten and moribund. And so it ties into people's political crusades. Yeah.
And that presumably is on sort of both ends of the spectrum. I mean, that's...
Yes, and it's both ends of the spectrum because there is a left-wing critique that modern capitalism is the root of all problems. On the right, there is a reactionary theoconservatism that blames the abandonment of church and faith and God and sometimes monarchy, and that that we'd be better off with with a kind of theocracy, throne and altar, as a way of giving us a moral system that is bigger than any one of us, and that the West's turn toward individualism, freedom, secular morality was a big mistake. And to point out that, well, actually, when people really were believers, we had the wars of religion and the Inquisition and the Crusades, complicates that narrative.
And is part of it purely psychological, though? I mean, is there an element of human nature which is just that, kind of for evolutionary reasons, are we kind of hardwired to think things are worse than they are because, you know, you're trying to avoid dying in evolutionary terms? So, you know, you're looking out for threats, you're not looking out for opportunities.
Yes, there is a negativity bias in human psychology, which is pretty well documented, that basically any negatively charged emotion or event is psychologically more powerful than its positive counterpart. There are more words for negative emotions than for positive emotions. People remember recent negative events more than positive events. And I think you're right in that ultimately that can be explained by the fact there really are more things that can go wrong than can go right. And the things that can go wrong can do you a lot more harm than the things that can go right can help you. And so it does stand to reason that our sense of vigilance and fear would be tuned to what goes wrong. And if there are historical changes, historical improvements that are measured out over decades or even centuries, we're ill-equipped to appreciate them.
Mm. And then I guess there's a sort of vaguer criticism out there about tone, which is that, yes, things have got better and you know, without disputing any of the data, that didn't happen by just people sitting back in their chairs and saying things are getting better, but we got here by people, you know, being very worried about how bad things were and trying to make them better. So, you know, what's your response to that kind of category of criticism?
Yes, well, I certainly would not make the lunatic argument that we should ignore problems. Quite the contrary. Yep. It's only when you recognize problems that you should solve them. But our understanding of the world should be one that is as accurate as possible, that there is no benefit to believing that things have gotten worse that in reality have gotten better. Of course, there are always problems. We always have to be aware of them. But there is no advantage whatsoever to being deluded about the course of history. Mm-hmm. And at the same time that there has to be a fear, a concern of genuine threats, there also has to be an appreciation of the human ability to solve problems. Otherwise, the rational response would be fatalism. That is, why even bother trying to improve things? You can't change human nature. You can't. The poor will always be with you. And there can be an enervating fatalism and inaction if one has a view of reality that does not acknowledge the fact that problems have been solved in the past.
And I think this is why you say you prefer describing things as a, rather than optimism, you prefer, is it possibilism or is it
a term that I lifted from Hans Rosling.
Yes, exactly.
And another term that he invented, and I envy his wordsmithing abilities, is the title of his posthumous book with Ola Rosling and Anna Rosamund, Factfulness.
Yes, yeah.
That it's not a question of optimism, it's a question that, because whether poverty has increased or decreased, war deaths have increased or decreased, it's not a matter of seeing the glasses half full. It's a matter of being aware of facts, which we know that most people are unaware of. People systematically get the wrong answers, give the wrong answers to questions like, has poverty been increasing or decreasing?
Yeah, I love that evidence of people sort of so caught up in their own political sort of presumptions about all of this. I think is it David Graeber, I think he's an anarchist kind of anthropologist or something. You quote a tweet from him in your book where he basically says something like, I've seen all this data out there pushing a neoliberal agenda about how the world is getting better, and like, there's not much out there to counter it. Can anyone kind of help me find that data?
please help me show that it doesn't exist.
You know, there is.
Yeah, precisely.
And so, as you said, this is not, marking the progress we've made is not the same thing as glibly dismissing problems or denying their existence or anything. So, you know, when we look at the big problems out there, you know, which ones are you worried about? Which ones do you think some of the more alarmist headlines maybe are more justified than other problems?
Certainly climate change would top the list. There's excellent reason to believe that we're taking enormous risks with climate because of the emission of greenhouse gases. The threat of nuclear war ought to be taken seriously, not because I think it's particularly likely, but because it's certainly not infinitesimally unlikely, and mm-hmm. the damage could be so catastrophic. More prosaically, the possibility of secular stagnation of the economy, of a slowing down of economic growth for a number of reasons is something to be concerned of. And I think the growth of authoritarian populism, which in many ways is the answer to the question, what's the opposite of Enlightenment ideals? Mm. Authoritarian populism is... derives its morality from tribalism, from religious faith, from obedience to authority. It is deeply opposed to the possibility of progress by seeking to wrench society backwards to some, in fact, non-existent golden age. Mm-hmm. It's hostile to institutions of enlightenment, such as liberal democracy, such as free trade, such as organizations for international cooperation. And so the rise of authoritarian populism in the nearer term is, I think, a genuine threat.
But on these things, I mean, take climate change, for example, you're, again, optimistic is a bad word, but you sort of believe in our ability to, these are problems that can be solved. This is not like a apocalyptic event that is
well, I wouldn't engage in that prophecy that is that we will solve it, because I don't know whether we'll solve it, and there are a lot of reasons I think we may not. The question is, can we solve it? And given that what happens in 30 years depends entirely on what we do now, it's I think futile to try to predict what will happen in 30 years. Mm-hmm. But one can say, of the choices facing us now, what ought we to do? And I do argue for a combination of, first of all, I argue against some of the popular responses to climate change, such as we've got to undo capitalism, we've got to reverse the Industrial Revolution, we've got to go back to a simpler, more sustainable lifestyle. I do believe that there is no turning back from our demand for energy. And the challenge is, how do we get the energy that we, and by we I mean humanity, not the West, because the rest of the world is going to demand abundant energy. And so any solution to climate change is going to have to accommodate the desire of China and India and Indonesia for the energy that we currently enjoy. I argue against a number of responses that are not solutions to the problem of climate change. I argue that we should look toward decarbonizing the world economy as rapidly as possible. And I suggest a combination of policy, like carbon pricing in particular, and technology, such as the implementation of zero carbon energies that we have now, such as light water reactors, and the investment in even better zero carbon technologies in the future, perhaps small modular reactors or other fourth generation nuclear technologies, carbon capture and storage, smart grids, probably. And since we can't predict now what the most scalable forms of zero carbon energy are going to be, maybe it'll be solar and wind with storage. I doubt it. But if it is, we should find out and pursue the solution as expeditiously as possible.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Let's talk about the Enlightenment values that you that you certainly attribute some of this progress to, or a lot of this progress to. Where do you see the threats to those values in modern society? Where do you see that coming? Those threats coming from?
We've already talked about authoritarian populism. Mm-hmm. This is not just philosophical speculation or the intellectual brain trust behind authoritarian populism, which does exist. It's not an oxymoron. They explicitly anti-Enlightenment thinkers for their inspiration. Nietzsche and mm-hmm. Heidegger and various Evola, various fascist crackpots of the early decades of the 20th century, and they make no bones about them. Those are their intellectual interests, influences. Authoritarian populism, religious moralities, one's a religious theoconservatism, as Damon Linker has called it, the idea that that our politics ought to be oriented around religious values and give authority to religious thinkers. To Marxism and its versions of the forms of socialism that have become popular in the American political mm-hmm. scene,
and on those threats, I mean, people would say historically those threats don't crop up unless something economically and socially is going wrong somewhere. So you know that isn't the rise of populism, the rise of far left politics and so on, is that not in itself sort of evidence that the status quo, people aren't progressing in the way mm-hmm. that they would like to
be? So I think there's something to that, and I consider a central idea to this whole enterprise to diagnose current problems and to ceaselessly try to solve them. And indeed, because technology changes, always changes, institutions change more slowly than technology, so they have to catch up. Mm. There are demographic changes. There are political changes. Ideas can themselves be causal influences. The Enlightenment project, if you want to call it that, involves constant recognition of problems. One of the ones that is facing us now is clearly the effects of globalization, that even though on the whole it has been a huge benefit to humanity, nothing benefits everyone to the same extent. Mm-hmm. And areas of deindustrialization in the United States, for example, have been suffering. And our current institutions ought to figure out how to make sure their lives just don't get worse and worse. Even if, on the whole, globalization has been good, nothing's good for everyone. Likewise, the pileup of student indebtedness, especially mm-hmm. in the United States, is a problem that we haven't yet figured out how to solve. The threat of job replacement by robots and artificial intelligence. And even the vulnerabilities in human nature to certain kinds of demagogues, both socialists and populists, that they may always be the threat, that they can capitalize on vulnerabilities in human nature. Our susceptibility to charismatic leaders, our tendency to blame problems, which there always will exist, on evil people. So even if while not disagreeing with your premise mm-hmm. that the rise of these alternatives suggests that there are unsolved problems, even if there aren't unsolved problems, there are vulnerabilities in human nature which would need to be countered, where the advantages would need to be stated in language that is compelling to new generations.
And what about, you know, what about the places that are supposed to be the places like this, like Harvard, that are supposed to be the sort of vanguard of Enlightenment values? You know, maybe there's a caricature out there, but there is an idea that identity politics and sort of the politics of free speech and so on mean that these aren't places where the search for truth and so on is quite as sort of full-blooded as it once was, and so therefore you're sort of you've messed with the formula that has delivered all this.
Yeah, no, I think that's an, I would agree that that is another threat to carrying on the Enlightenment project. If the institutions that in theory ought to be specialized to advance those ideas are corroded by kind of intellectual tribalism and demonization. So yeah, I think that's a severe problem, not only in pursuing disinterested inquiry into questions like what in fact reduces crime, what in fact increases prosperity, but also in sapping the credibility of the academy as an institution. And I often get kind of skepticism even about matters that are a matter of scientific near consensus, like anthropogenic climate change, based on the cynicism that academia is so infected with political correctness that we shouldn't trust anything that comes out of a university. Mm-hmm. And I think in the case of climate change, the scientific arguments speak for themselves. But still, we do have to secure the credibility of the academy by not surrendering to illiberal antics I don't want to blame it just on students, because they are enabled by university administrations themselves.
Okay, let's. I'll ask one question. Final question. You published Enlightenment Now last year. The paperback is out. They're all available in all good bookshops.
Yes.
Do you think the message is getting through? I mean, that not just your work, but the broader project that you and others do in terms of sort of like Hans Rosling is a good example of another person doing something similar, of explaining the sort of progress that's been made. Do you think that the intellectual climate is changing at all, or are you pushing back against a wave of pessimism that you're never going to?
Too soon to tell, I think, because it has just been a year, and so the best I can say is that there are currents that are in the direction that I would like to see go, despite the often the demonization of millennials and Gen Zs. I see a lot of support among students for free speech, open inquiry, pursuit of solutions. How strong that is not easy to gauge, but it certainly exists. I've gotten a lot of support from political leaders who've met with me, not so much because I have policy advice, which I don't, but just to reinforce and ratify the idea that institutions of liberal democracy are worth defending.
Which ones, can I ask? Which?
I've met with Justin Trudeau. I met with, I conferred with Michael Bloomberg. I've met with Mauricio Macri of Argentina. I met with Vicente Fox, former president of Mexico. I met with Obama's speechwriters when he was still president. I did meet Obama himself, but I take no credit there because I was a trailing spouse. My wife, Rebecca Goldstein, was awarded the National Medal of the Humanities at the White House. Mm-hmm. And
you were there as a proud husband.
I was there as a proud husband, but I did get to meet the president and told him about our common connection in his speechwriters. And his speechwriters actually did contact me toward the end of his presidency to fact-check some claims he was making about democracy and economic growth.
So the message is, you think slowly but surely it's...
Well,
You don't want to say.
I don't want a prophecy, but I do think it's important to get it out there, to provide and to try to inject some passion toward the institutions of enlightenment that are very easy to take for granted, because they're there. They're there to be blamed for everything that goes wrong. They don't tend not to attract charismatic leaders and slogans and rallies. There was a time in which there was a great enthusiasm when the United Nations was a prestigious organization, when democracy was an ideal that would lead people's eyes to tear up. I'm not the person to kind of gin up that kind of emotional support, but I would like to see more emotion and passion behind ideas that we have reason to believe work.
Steven Pinker, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Steven Pinker. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.